Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming design, all things gaming related, gaming hobbyist.
At this point, I think it's worth mentioning that we don't write that part of the intro down. He just kind of does it off the cuff.
Yeah, off the cuff. I mean, it's all the tags that I put on every blog post on our website, so it's not hard to forget. So this is another weekly episode where we talk about a specific game, we dig into the strategy of it, how to play it, and we talk about the game design of it. And May is our greatest hits. Madest hits? No, it's dumb. It doesn't work. It's not really the greatest hits of our podcast, but rather the greatest hits of our tastes. And these are also games that we've mentioned on the podcast a number of times that we haven't done dedicated episodes to yet, and we thought we should, just to clue you guys in on what they're all about so you know what we're referencing every time we reference it.
Fun fact, this episode, the game we're covering, was also recommended by one of our listeners.
Yes.
We do take your feedback into consideration when choosing the games we cover. Mm-hmm. This happened to be, at the time, the only game that was requested, so, you know, better time than ever.
Sure. Yeah. And the game, of course, is...
Millennium Blades.
Millennium Blades.
It is designed by D. Brad Talton Jr., published by Level 99 Games.
Sorry if you can hear our dog barking right now. Published by Level 99 Games in 2016.
Yep. And as far as recognition goes, it was nominated for a couple of awards. Didn't win anything, but it was nominated for Golden Geek Most Innovative Card Game and Best Themed Game in that year. And there is a very clear reason why it was in consideration for those. This is a very unique card game.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So, without any further ado, here is Millennium Blades' short synopsis written by me. In Millennium Blades, players take on the roles of collectors and tournament goers of the fictional trading card game of the same name, Millennium Blades. Players spend rounds in the game buying packs, which I say with quotes, amassing and collecting cards, selling cards in the aftermarket, trading cards for more rare cards, and assembling a tournament-ready deck, which I also say with quotes, of 8 cards plus accessories. And each card in the game has individual attributes and effects that allow you to score points and interact with your opponents during the tournament. Players score victory points in the game based on the sizes of their collections and where they finish in the tournament, and whoever has the most points after 3 rounds of card sharking and tournament grinding, the player with the most points wins. So that is Millennium Blades. It is a game about the metagame surrounding a trading card game.
On the box, it even says CCG Simulator Card Game.
Yes. So, yeah, you're buying packs of cards and opening them. They're not really packs because the cards in this game are designed to have, on the back of them, look like a sealed pack of cards.
Yeah.
But it's just one card. And opening the pack is just buying it and looking at it, the other side of it. So that is Millennium Blades. But there's a lot more detail to it. So let's get into the strategy of the game and talk about more about the gameplay. Let's get more into the gameplay and the strategy involved. So first of all, when you set up the game, you combine a ton of cards together into one massive deck, which is kind of like the shop, I guess, is what the game calls it. And the shop has a large stack of cards from a core set, and then you add to it cards from many other kinds of sets. So you have the core set, but then you also have, you have small expansions, you have master expansions, you have
premium expansions.
And these all go together, multiple different kinds of expansions, much like a trading card game. Just think of any trading card game and how they have different expansions with other kinds of cards in them. And you're sort of, you put all of them together into one shuffled deck.
One giant deck.
And each player starts with their own starter deck, But then the rest of the game is played by acquiring cards from this new large shop deck, and then eventually trading them in for promo cards, which are they're a little bit better than your average card, but you have to trade, you know, anywhere from 5 to 9 cards in order to get one. And you also acquire promo cards after each tournament. But for the most part, you're acquiring cards from this deck throughout the game.
Right. You can get you can buy 10 cards, or there's like a choice of 10 cards from the shop at mm-hmm. any given time. There are 9 cards from the top of the deck set aside in their own sort of space, mm-hmm. or you can always buy the top card of the deck.
Yeah, and it is a trade row, so every time you buy a card from the shop area, you will replace it with the top card of the deck and reveal the next top card. So it's a cycling shop, a trade row that you're buying from, and you're only seeing the backs of the cards, which is important to note, because you are buying packs, technically.
Right.
So I want to say just right now, as a strategy note, and this is more of like a house rule, I guess, that we probably should have done when we played through the game this last time, was you want to probably go over each expansion with every player, just to understand what they do and what they're all about. Now, it's not mandatory because, as we'll talk about later in the design, you can kind of pick up what each expansion is about just by seeing 1 or 2 cards from it. But it's still very helpful just to understand, like, what are the different kinds of strategies that are going to be involved in the game, especially later on during the tournament mode. Yeah, so it's sort of a house rule. Look at all the expansions, get a general idea of what they're all about before you start mixing them all together with the core sets. Do the same thing for the promotional cards, too, just to have an idea of what you're going up against in the future and what to expect. Because, again, you're only seeing the backs of the cards. So once you have the deck set up, you have a buy phase and a tournament phase. So the buy phase, it lasts, there's 2 rounds of 7 minutes where you get to buy and sell whatever you want. And then there's a round of 6 minutes where you can't sell, but you can buy, and you can sort of just go over the cards that you've acquired and organize them. But, when you're buying, you have a limited amount of money. And you can't just buy whatever. You start out with $30. Base packs cost $3, and then anything else costs more. And you can sell up to 4 cards in the game, unless one of your cards gets bought by another player, then you gain additional cards that you can sell.
Or unless you trade in for a promo card.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get to is that there is, you have a limited amount of money in the game for each round, so you need to be very careful with what you buy, to an extent. Sometimes you're just going to have to buy something, because you have to have, you know, a deck by the time the tournament starts, and it's better to have 8 cards ready for your deck rather than just like 7 that you think will work together. You know, it's better to take a shot in the dark and hope that something comes up that will fit into your deck. But at the same time, it's good to know what each pack, what each expansion will do, just by... You should be able to tell what they do just by looking at the back of the card, by reviewing them before you start the game, so that you can make informed decisions in the middle of the game, and that'll help clear up a lot of the confusion and frustration that can happen in a game if you're not familiar with all the cards.
And what is also notable is that with this whole thing, that the expansions that cost more to buy blindly, mm-hmm. the higher ones, the Masters packs and whatever, those do tend to have more powerful cards, just like in a vacuum.
Sure.
But, I mean, they cost like almost double what a base sort of set card would cost.
Right.
And so a lot, strategy-wise, a lot of the part of the during the deck building phase is gauging quality over quantity. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you do want to buy a lot of the cheapest core set cards, because it either gives you stuff you can consider trading in, or it gives you more options for your collection, or it gives you more things you could sell.
Mm-hmm.
And since there's a large amount of those compared to the other sets, then it's more likely that you're going to end up with multiples of those in the trade row. Like, we had, like, some parts during the game where there were, like, 7 or 8 all together, between that and the top of the deck.
Mm-hmm.
So don't be afraid to get those cheap core set cards, I should say.
Yeah.
Like, you can easily fall into the trap of seeing a super powerful master set card and wanting to buy it immediately, but then you're going to run out of money really quick and you won't have a good deck for the tournament phase.
Mm-hmm.
Which, the game even says in the rulebook, the tournament phase is where most of the victory points come from.
Right.
So that's most of what you should be prioritizing.
Right, because with the collection, to describe just what that is that by the end of the buying phase, you can select an element or a type. And by the way, we should go over exactly what the cards do on the front, but just know that each card has an element and a type, kind of like Pokemon.
Or you could think of it like that. Or Magic.
Or Yu-Gi-Oh. That's a good one. Yeah, exactly. So you just choose one of those, and then you want to assemble cards of different star values. And star values is another attribute that every card has. Think of it like levels in Yu-Gi-Oh, mana cost in Magic.
Yeah.
So you assemble cards of the same type, different star values, but only like if you have four cards in your collection, that's only, I think, 7 points. I think 2 cards is 2 points, 3 cards is 4, 4 cards is 7, 5 is 9.
And 12,
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah, so the number of cards you're getting for each collection, or the number of points you're getting for your collection sizes aren't much compared to the tournament, which I think last place in the first tournament gives you 12 points.
With 3 players.
With three players, with right.
4, it gives you 9, I believe. But
So getting last place in a tournament is worth just as much as investing, like, 4 or 5 cards into a collection. 5 cards into a collection, at least. Which is a lot. Five cards is the minimum you need to trade in for a bronze promo, which could make for a pretty strong deck.
Or it worthless.
Yeah, so either way, yeah. It's more points from the tournament and less points from the collection. But that is what a collection is. So you're buying cards, you're constructing a deck, you're making a collection. Let's talk a little bit about what the cards do individually on the other side. So we mentioned that they have the star value. Now, the star value doesn't matter with what cards you can play. When it comes to the tournament, the gameplay is just play a card every turn in your tableau, which has a limited number of slots. It has 6 slots, so you're only going to be playing 6 of the 8 cards that you put in your deck. So anyways, the cards have a star value, they have an element, they have a type, they have a name, obviously, and then they all have a number of effects between them that all revolve around earning points. And the points you earn in the tournament are different than the victory points you get at the end of the tournament, which is kind of a confusing distinction. But just know that the way it works is you get victory points for your collection and victory points for winning tournaments. And those are what matter to determine who wins the game at the end of the game. The points you earn in the tournament, which I guess we can just call tournament points.
I think they're called round points, RP.
Round points?
Yeah.
Let's call them tournament points, sure. Just for clarity. The tournament points you earn, they just determine your placement.
They show how well you did in the tournament.
Exactly. They just first, second, third, fourth. And those determine from a chart how many victory points you get from your place in the tournament. So with all this in mind, in the beginning stage of the game, when you're buying cards, the strategies that you're using are a lot of your deck building and card drafting strategies that you would pick up if you draft trading cards, or if you, you know, construct trading card decks in a constructed format, or if you play deck building games like Dominion or whatever. You're trying to realize the synergies between card effects that will give you the most points in the tournament. And you need to do that kind of quickly, and you need to do that on the fly, which is also quickly, in order to make sure that you're going to have good combos of cards for your tournament later after the buying. And you're keeping that in mind while you're also managing your money in the buy phase.
Also worth noting, really quick on the subject of what each card has as like its properties,
mm-hmm.
that on the backs of each card, where it shows like the pack sort of, it has basically a list of what each card in the set's type and element are. So mm-hmm. you can kind of gauge just by looking at the back of the cards in the trade row, like, oh, this set is more likely to have a citizen type than a soldier type.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes into play because before each round of deck building and card acquisition, the element meta is revealed, which gives you extra tournament points if you have a card of a specific element.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the first period during the deck building phase, before the second one, you reveal the other meta, which is the type meta.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might want to keep an eye out on cards that might not be as powerful as it, like by itself, but because the meta cards are guaranteed to give you 15 points per, then, I mean, it's just worth 15 points most of the time, which is about average for like a 4 or 5 cost card.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 15 points. And generally, as a rule of thumb, I think 15 points is the least number of points that you would expect to get from a single card in order to have a decent game.
Yeah.
Because you want to try and get at least 100 points. So I guess it's slightly more than 15 points, because if you get 15 points from each card and you play 6 cards,
that's 90.
That's 90. So that's close. And then maybe you get 10 points from your deck box, which is an accessory that comes in packs.
But then there's also accessories, which yeah. are accessories.
Yes, yeah, which are accessories packs. That come in packs. So, you other than the 8 cards in your deck, you also have 3 cards that accompany them that are the deck box and 2 like accessory items. So if you can expect to get 90 cards from each of your 90 points from the 6 cards you play, and then 10 points from one of those 3 accessories, then you're at 100, and that's a good place to be for a tournament. More than 100 will guarantee you like a victory in most cases.
First or second place.
Yeah, you'll be like jockeying for first and second place when you crack 100 points. So you mentioned the meta. That's one thing to keep in mind while you're building your deck, is like, if you can sometimes towards maybe the end of the buying phase, if you don't have one of those 2 metas in your tournament deck, then you can sort of just look over the backs of the cards and just buy the packs that have the most, like, the highest chance of giving you a card. Because each individual pack has only 6 specific cards that can come in it.
Except for the core set.
And they show you the exact, you know, typing and pairings of each element and type on the back of the card. And you can see, like, oh, that one has more fire symbols, so yeah. there's more likely to get a fire card from that pack. Yeah. And I think the top card of the pack shows up a little less frequently than the bottom 5.
I think so.
It's kind of like a rare card in the pack. So keep that in mind when just evaluating if you're looking for a specific element or type. So one thing that I want to say as a strategy is that with the whole deck building skills, it's important to keep your cards organized while you're shuffling them around. You know, technically you got to keep them in like a hand, but I'm not opposed to just making piles in front of you. And one thing that's really good to do is just start building your deck from the beginning, and setting aside the cards and getting to the 8 cards you need as quick as you can. And then, you know, tooling with it as you progress through the rest of the buying phase, which I don't think we mentioned has a 7-minute period, Okay, good. I forgot. Anyways, yeah. So make piles, make a pile for the cards that'll be in your deck, make a pile for the cards that'll be in your collection, and then keep the rest of your cards in your hand so that you can easily make snap decisions on when you want to sell a card. And when you want to trade cards in for a more rare card, because obviously you don't want to accidentally sell the cards in your deck or trade in the cards in your deck. It's easier to just keep track of...
You don't want to put the cards from your deck in your collection.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's important to do that, and it kind of helps you manage things. It can help you say, like, okay, what do I need for my deck? So you can just drop everything and look at the individual cards in your deck and say, like, okay, here's the strategies I got going on. Maybe I could look for more of this. Or you can drop, you know, something else and you can look at your hand and say, like, well, what kind of a collection can I start? And if I did, then what would I be missing out for potential deck cards? And eventually you can just be like, okay, what can I just throw away for better cards?
Also, since you can't sell cards during the 6-minute period, mm-hmm. it gives you oftentimes a lot more time to just sort of make last minute decisions about your deck. Since you might not be able to buy anything at that point, you can just spend the time to make sure you understand what you're doing.
Yeah, that can, yeah, because, you know, you have 8 cards in your deck, but you're only going to play 6 of them because you only have 6 spots in your tableau. So, yeah, it's a good idea just during that 6-minute period to look at the cards, figure out the order you want to play them in, figure out which 2 you're not going to play, or maybe consider which number of cards are kind of flexible positions, right, where depending on what kind of cards your opponents are playing, you might slightly swap out the strategy that you're planning with those extra 2 cards.
And that's a point I wanted to get to about the tournament phase and strategy for that, mm-hmm. is you don't want to have a strategy that completely hinges on 1 or 2 cards. You want to have a pretty flexible deck when you go to the tournament phase. Mm-hmm. This is because one of the main forms of interaction and sort of costs in the tournament phase is flipping cards over.
Yep.
So some cards will have an action where you can do that once per turn during the tournament phase along with playing a card. And when you take the action, you flip the card over. And a card that's face down has no properties, no stats, no star level, no name, no whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of there.
In addition to that, there's a couple cards that will flip over your opponent's cards, right, or flip over your own cards.
There's quite a few. A good amount, maybe more than half of the different sets in the game are based around that.
Right.
And so since a lot of times you can end up flipping over your opponent's cards, it is worth considering, like, your opponent could flip over a card you have and completely ruin your strategy.
Right.
And then you just won't be able to make up the difference in points.
Right. So it's important not to hedge all your bets on just 1 card,
yeah,
or 2 cards. And it's also important not to plan on any specific, like, combination of cards. Like, especially a very specific, like, if I play all my cards in this order, then I will win. You can't always guarantee that because, you know, that plan might rely on cards sticking around,
right,
till the next round.
Or you can make your opponents discard cards,
mm-hmm, right,
which just makes them kind of go away.
So it's important to plan for that strategy-wise. There's... Other than just having sort of like a more flexible strategy with interchangeable parts, where if you lose 1 piece, you won't be totally out of the game. There's a couple items that will help to prevent you from flipping cards. And I think these are the most important items in the game. Or accessories, I should say, because that's what they're called in the game, is accessories. If you can find accessories that prevent your opponents from flipping your cards over... then you at least have a little security and you can plan for a little more boom or bust strategies because of that, which will end up giving you more points in the long run because you can make that kind of risk.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a strategy for deck building and drafting. So to go into a little more detail of how the tournament works... Again, you have your 8 cards. They call it a deck, but it's really just your hand, and you can play any of them at any given time. You don't have to play them in an order as if they were stacked like a deck, is what I'm trying to say. And then you have your deck box and your 2 accessories. Those are face up on your board. Everyone can see those. They might clue you into what your opponents are trying to do if you can see what their deck box and accessories do. And then starting with, in the first round, the last person to have opened an actual pack of cards in real life, and then starting with the winner of every previous tournament in later rounds, you take turns just playing 1 card from your hand and performing 1 action. You can only perform the action if you play a card, but you don't have to do them in that order. You can do an action, then play a card,
yeah,
in some cases. But you play 1 card, you do 1 action, and then the next person gets their turn. And this goes until everyone passes. Meaning that they either have a full tableau and they have no actions that they want to perform, or they just don't want to play any more cards. And there's some cases where you'll want to do that. But for the most part, it's usually when everyone has a full tableau. And then when that happens, you check to see who has the most points. If there's any cards that have a score ability, this happens at the end of a tournament. You score their points. And then whoever has the most points gets the highest reward, and so on and so forth in victory points.
Everyone gets a promo card.
Yes, at the end of the tournaments, the first tournament and the second tournament, everyone gets a promo card. And I mentioned that you have a starter deck at the beginning of the game. Every card that you don't use in your collection or your tournament deck goes to what is called a binder, but that is almost point, like, those cards are pretty much, like, exiled. They're out of the game. You don't really...
They're just a personal discard, really.
Yeah, you don't really count for them and in later parts of the game. There's only... I only saw one card in the game that actually cared about the binder. For the most part, they're just gone. So, so at the beginning of the game, you start with your starter deck, but all the cards that you collected, including your starter deck, at the end of that first round, gets discarded. So the next round, you start with a single promo card, and you start with dealing cards from the top of the deck. And in every round of the buying phase, except for the final round, you are dealt 6 cards from the top of the deck. Every player is. So you start with your starter deck and the 6 cards in the first round, and then after that, it's just 6 cards and 6 cards. You get the picture. Anyways, just small details, getting into the strategy of the game. So let's see, stay organized. Yeah. You can't sell during the third period, so make sure everything is settled, selling or trading, or selling wise, I guess, in the buying phase.
Also, worth noting is that since you can only sell 4 cards at a time, or have 4 cards in the market at any given time, a good way to liquidate cards is to trade them in, trade a bunch of cheap cards that are useless in for a promo, and then just sell the promo.
Mm-hmm.
Because the promos are almost always like 5 stars or higher.
Mm-hmm.
So they can usually give you more money than, you know, 2 cards being sold on the aftermarket that are useless otherwise.
Right. When you sell a card, you get money back equal to its star value.
Right.
And yeah, so like we said before, the master packs cost $6 to buy. And then the core pack costs $3 to buy, and then, you know, the other packs are in between those two. So generally, you want to be at least getting like $5 or $6 back from selling a card, just so that you have the option of buying like a high cost pack
or 2 cheap in exchange ones.
Or 2 cheap ones. And I think for the most part, the cheap packs will always give you cheap cards.
Yeah,
there's occasionally they'll give you a card worth more. And then the, you know, the more expensive packs will, on average, give you more expensive cards. Should we get into the design of the game?
I think so.
We talked a lot about the strategy, but the game design, so there are a ton of cards in this game, a ton of individually designed cards in this game, because this game practically just invented a trading card game. And then invented small expansions for the game, like a whole bunch of small expansions of the game, to the point where, I mean, you can use multiple different kinds of expansions in each game, and every game you use different expansions, so there's more than is necessary for just one playthrough.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of cards, is what I'm trying to say. A ton of cards.
In typical level 99 fashion.
So most of the design in this game comes from how, like, what kind of method they use to design all of these cards so that the game would work. Because it's a lot to ask a player to have to buy and sell cards in real time. This is a real time game.
Yeah.
You know,
is a turn based rule set, but its main rule set that takes up most of the rule book is the real time.
Yeah.
Game.
The one that they start you with, in the rule book. So it's a real-time game. It's a lot to ask a player to have to formulate the strategies, understand your game, in just 7 minutes.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, you have 7 minutes, and then 7 minutes, and then 6 minutes, whatever. So, you have 20 minutes to have to understand a whole game and beat your opponents in a different game than the one that you're playing during that 20 minutes when you're acquiring cards. They had to design the cards in a way that was easy to digest. Oh, I forgot there was one more strategy thing that should obviously be mentioned, and that's cards from the same set go together. So, you know, if anything, just focus on cards from the same set. So anyways, yeah, so they had to design a game within the game that's easy to digest, so that you can formulate your strategies fast enough in those 20 minutes of deck building, and so that you can evaluate cards on the fly right when you buy them and determine whether or not you want to sell them or add them to your deck or consider collecting them. So, how did they do this, Matthew?
So, one thing I can say is not each set is necessarily different.
Mm-hmm.
Many sets have very, very, very minor variations on the same central mechanic or synergy.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, it's not like you're playing with so many different sets. It's more like you're playing with five sets that have tiny different differences.
Right.
And by the way, I want to bring up real quick that almost all the sets, if not all of them, are parodies. So I'm going to be referencing them based on just sort of the general parody that they are.
Right.
So like the Mario set and the Garden Gnome set,
mm-hmm.
those both use flipping your own cards over as, like, the main mechanic. So what that kind of means is that they weren't really designing so many different mechanics that had to be understood at once. They were designing multiple that have, like, similar enough mechanics that if you look at them, you're able to judge them accordingly without having to know so much about the set as a whole, or, mm-hmm. like, by itself.
And I think that at the core of this design, is this principle that they tried to limit the number of attributes that that any given card could have. And so if you're dealing with a low number of attributes, then, you know, there's a good chance that any card will synergize with another card because they'll have very similar attributes. And I want to reference them or call them knobs, for a moment to sort of explain in a little more detail. And that, like, if you can imagine, like a synthesizer board, there's a bunch of knobs that you can turn to affect something. And each card in this game has the potential to use any one of these knobs. And the number of knobs that you include in, the design of a whole game will influence how individualistic each card is and therefore how well they interact with one another. So in this game, they kept it to a low number of knobs, I think, in order to achieve what you described, how cards will have very similar synergies and very, like, similar twists on the same sort of core mechanic.
Very platonically ideal sort of form.
Sure. So the knobs in the game, name isn't one that's really used a lot, but star number, element, type, these are pretty easy ones to consider in building a deck. There's a strategy in the game that involves having high star values on all of your cards and earning a lot of points because of that. And then there's strategies that involve having cards with higher star values defeat your opponent's cards with lower star values. And then element and type, they're like tribal in Magic or whatever, where, you know, just cards of similar elements and types will work together. Then, other than those attributes, there's also play effects, which are cards that have an effect when they come into play. There's actions, which, as you mentioned, are things that you can do in addition to playing a card on your turn, and performing them flips the card over. There's a mechanic called clashing, which involves comparing the top card of the store deck's star value and the star value of the rightmost card in your tableau to the same for your opponent, and whoever having the higher star value wins, and depending on who wins and who loses, and the card effect will do something in a clash. And then there's score effects, which are effects, like I mentioned before, that you earn you points at the end of a tournament. And then there's flipping, which is, you know, there's like actions cause your cards to flip, but other things can cause your cards to flip. And certain cards will give you points once they are flipped, or give you effects once they are flipped. There's discarding, which is, it comes up less than other effects, but it involves discarding your own cards or forcing your opponents to discard their cards. And then some cards utilize the aftermarket by placing cards in there and then obtaining cards from there. And some cards care about what set a card comes from. So just to run through that list one more time real quick, the knobs on any given card are name, star number, element, type, play effect, actions, clashing, scoring, flipping, and then to a lesser extent, discard, aftermarket, and set. So that's a little over 10 knobs. But as long as any given card cares about one or more of those knobs, then it will synergize with a large number of cards in the game. And in addition to that, to end my long explanation of all this, a lot of these knobs care about one another. For example, using an action is flipping a card. And so that can care, or that can aid with other flip effects. Flipping cancels out a card's score effect because it's no longer face up, so it no longer has its score effect. So there's an interaction there. It also cancels out all the other attributes of a card, the star type, the element, and the type of it. Those all turn face down, have no bearing on the game. So because the knobs work with each other, and because there's few of them, like you said, the cards have just a general synergy. Even when they have a unique strategy to them, the strategies will go together because they all care about the same kinds of knobs and attributes.
Yeah.
And description of this.
So, to step way back into a very metaphorical sense of the design of the game, this game follows sort of like another game we discussed by the same designer, Battlecon, in the idea of taking a concept of like a lifestyle or a game or whatever that is not already a board game, boiling it down to like the basic elements, and then turning that into a game. So it being a CCG simulator, from like a high concept standpoint, it has opening packs, going to the store, trading with friends, selling and buying cards on the secondary market, following the metagame and adjusting your deck accordingly, scrambling at the last minute to get your deck together for the tournament, and then that tense moment during the tournament. And even then, those are just like the basic parts of the game. Other things in the game, like star value, representing more of how powerful or good a card is also present. This appears not just in sort of just describing the game, but also the feel of playing the game pretty accurately depicts this. For example, I found myself many times throughout the game wondering what could have been had I picked a different card of the same set, or like agonizing over, so like if there were eight of the core set out, agonizing over which one of those to pick.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it doesn't matter. It's a Monty Hall type of thing, but I mean, at the same time, that is sort of how it feels like at times, mm-hmm. to buy booster packs at a store.
Mm-hmm.
Thumb through the box and get a lucky one.
Yeah, I think this, the general feeling that you get from playing this game that sort of simulates the metagame surrounding a trading right. card game, a lot of that comes from the time limit and the real time right. element of it.
The franticness and the literally throwing money around to just try to get the right cards,
mm-hmm.
and beating others to the punch getting certain cards.
It's kind of funny, too, that it kind of, like, heightens the contrast between the deck building and the scrambling and everything, and then the tournament.
Yeah.
Because it goes from a real-time game into a turn-based game where you're given as much time as you want to think about something.
It's sort of ironically the opposite of a real card game, where normally you spend a lot of time kind of relaxing and looking through decks and testing, but then the tournament's really tense.
Yeah.
Instead, in this game, the deck building and getting cards is super tense and frustrating, and then the tournament's kind of calm, like a breather.
Yeah.
Like, you just kind of play your cards. It's not, you don't have to think as quickly and strain yourself as much.
Maybe that kind of simulates more of the pro, like, lifestyle when it comes to trading card games. Like, a pro Magic player will be scrambling, the night before a big tournament.
To adjust their deck for the meta.
Yeah, to adjust their deck for the perfect meta game. They're constantly play testing so that they know exactly what they do in every given situation against any kind of strategy of deck, right? It's very frantic leading up to the tournament. But then when you watch tournaments play, or when you watch professionals play in a tournament like we have, you know that they play very slowly and very measured and very calm. They take their time to consider, you know, the situation. It's like a chess player. They're thinking X turns ahead and they want to make the most optimal plays and mitigate, you know, as much randomness as they can and pull ahead of their opponent. So it kind of like, you know, gives that sort of feeling to the game where it's kind of like the pro player playing a trading card game.
And even though like it has such a focus on sort of just sort of bullet points of the lifestyle, the Brad Talton Jr. also knew which ones to focus more on. Like, the metagame is a big part of competitively playing card games. It's represented just by a small deck of cards, twice, one for element, one for type.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets what it needs to across, which is it puts an importance on certain types of cards and makes you reconsider them based on the upcoming tournament as information comes out.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, that's all it needed to be to get that across.
It's also kind of funny that they reveal the second one later because, you know, a metagame can slightly shift right before a tournament.
There could be a new development.
Yeah.
And also, with that in mind, a lot of card games have a large emphasis on building a really weird deck or abusing certain combinations or whatever. And that's somewhat apparent with those, you know, mechanics and whatnot. But it's not as important as it might be in a real competitive card game because, I mean, it wouldn't fit with the rest of the game. Enough is there to feel like you're building an actual deck with a real strategy and going to a tournament with it, but it's not too much that it overshadows the rest of the game.
Right.
Let's see. Something I find really funny, so the game has, you know, fake money, whatever. When you get it, it comes with stickers that you bundle up into wads of cash.
Yeah, so I like this.
So the $1 is a wad of ones. This is really funny for one thing. It's like a jab at the price that some trading card games take.
Uh-huh.
But it's also really like a good quality of life thing because when you're in real time, it can be hard to, you know, manipulate money. You might get too much, you might not get enough when you're trying to make transactions.
Mm-hmm.
Having these fat wads of cash, like, it lets you sort through them quickly, make sure you're getting the right change.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's just like a simple thing they did in the physical design of the game that really changes, like, the tactile, like, the physical playing of the game.
Yeah.
Instead of just managing these really thin, papery bills that everyone hates to use in Monopoly, it's these fat stacks of cash.
They also don't get blown around the table as much.
Yeah, yeah, they're heavy. You know, you're throwing them out, you're slamming them down. They make noise when you drop them or something. It's fun to just like slam, even just $6. Even I think it was funny. It's funny when you're playing because like the ones. They're just because they're bundled, they're deceptive how many you actually have. Like,
yeah.
I'll look at my hand of cards and be like, oh my gosh, I have so much money here.
And then I count it. Three cards.
Yeah.
Like, oh.
Yeah. And then I count it and I'm like, oh, I only have seven ones, but it feels like I have 20 because they're just bundled this way.
It's an interesting psychological thing that I think it helps the game though.
Yeah.
The game, since it's real time and you feel this pressure of the time limit approaching, it does sort of rush you to make poor decisions, which I think helps balance the game. Because I think sometimes there are clearly better cards than others, but because there's a time limit, you have to just sort of roll with it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to accept losses.
Mm-hmm. I like it. You can compare the cash to like a game that uses metal coins for their money rather than just like cardboard chits. But you know, it's a very inexpensive way of doing that instead of having to actually have metal coins made.
It costs a lot of paper.
Yeah. Paper doesn't, especially the paper that they use for money,
it
costs nothing. So, you know, just print it like five times as much money and then put a sheet of stickers in there to bundle them up.
Also, something interesting I noticed about the real-time time limits when mm-hmm. we played, I don't know if this was intentional, that it adds an interesting gameplay loop to the game where you go through the same sort of flow of The first time period is usually acquiring a lot of cards because you have all this money and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Period two is a mixture of actually building your deck and then sort of cutting cards, selling, trying to scrape by and figure out what you can get with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
And then period three was always like just last minute decisions.
Yeah, it kind of ramps down in the like the hecticness of
right.
and the exchanging of resources.
It's paced interestingly.
And
I
don't
know. The first round's like super hectic in movement. The second one's more stressful because mm-hmm. you have to make really harsh decisions then.
Well, one thing that probably affects that is that the special packs and the master packs get bought up more often than the core set. And so by the second round, the shop and the top of the deck is mostly core set.
Yeah.
In some cases. There's still a couple random packs that maybe people just aren't interested in buying, but for the most part, it's core set. So you're less incentivized to buy the packs there in that case. In another case, it's kind of like a psychological thing where you have very few cards and very few synergies, so you kind of have to just start acquiring cards and figuring out what you're doing, and you have to take more shots in the dark to start with. And if your first shot misses, then you have to keep shooting until you find
Some
place to build from.
You really can't form your strategy from your six cards that you get dealt with in the first round.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to actually start buying cards to figure out what you're going to do,
mm-hmm.
what you're going to try to do.
Yeah, exactly. So it does kind of play that way just through the design of the game. That it sort of slows down a little bit for the second and third rounds. Sometimes when we were playing, we even ended up with extra time in the second and third rounds of some buying phases because, you know, we just figured it out quick enough.
And we didn't have any more money.
And we sometimes either we didn't have any more money or we knew that we were going to draw six more cards for the second round. So we just decided, like, I'm going to save the money I have now. And, you know, you make that kind of a decision in real life, too, when it's like... do I invest now in the good cards or do I wait a
financing.
Little bit? Do I wait a little bit for the meta to clear up a little more so I know exactly what I should be going for? But it's interesting.
Yeah. And I think the pacing part helps in a game like this where you're spending, you know, about an hour total, you know, actually doing real-time frantic stuff.
Yeah, because it's three periods of 20 minutes.
Yeah, setting it up that way with shorter periods and then having them kind of ramp down in speed and pacing, I think helps make it bearable.
Mm-hmm.
If it was just 1 hour of this, I couldn't manage it,
yeah.
I don't think.
Yeah, the game went by surprisingly quick.
Yeah.
Because of that.
I do have a bad thing about the design I want to point out.
Okay.
So we mentioned that you have to shuffle all those cards together.
Oh, yeah, there's probably about 500 or 600 cards in the shop deck at the beginning of the game.
Yeah, and it's a pain to shuffle, and it's even more of a pain at the end of the game to break it all down into individual sets again.
Mm-hmm, because before, when you set up the game, you have to choose from the individual types of packs
or types of
expansions.
Type.
Exactly. So you have to put in like the minor expansions, the major expansions,
the masters.
Yeah, and all these cards get shuffled into that deck, and then you know the promo cards are set aside, but those eventually get shuffled into your deck through, you know, trading them for them and putting them in your deck and then discarding them to your binder or whatever, or selling them. So yeah, everything gets mixed up in this game. And it's a lot of work to assemble them at the beginning and then redistribute them at the end.
It's the same problem I have with eating crab.
Yeah.
It takes too much work for fun sometimes.
Yeah.
The fun to work ratio is too low.
It's but also kind of a problem that you have just playing trading card games. If you do a lot of like drafting and open a lot of packs, you just get a ton of cards that you're not going to be using in your deck. So, you know, you got to organize them or store
them. It's not worth it to bulk trade.
Yeah.
It's just, it doesn't feel good, but you don't know what to do with them. And since it's so fluctuating, you never know if they're ever going to be useful. So you hoard them.
Yeah.
But also, the thing about shuffling a huge deck like that, it could actually be like a physical barrier from preventing people from playing the game.
Because
shuffling is a technique that you have to learn, especially when you get to huge decks, just managing that.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, like, I mean, you have to think about, you know, if somebody with like a disability wanted to play the game, they just might not be able to set it up by themselves or, you know... It puts an unnecessary barrier, I feel like, into the game.
Plus, you know, if you don't shuffle it properly, then
it
you
ruins
could,
it.
Yeah, I mean, you could end up with, like, all the MasterCards in one part of the deck, you know.
Or, like, you could just only see core set cards because it's the top of the deck.
Exactly, yeah, because there's significantly more. It's more than half of the cards in the basic deck are core set cards. And so it takes a lot to try and distribute all of the individual expansions so that it's all evenly, or not really evenly, but randomly distributed in a good way. Mm-hmm. That takes a lot of shuffling. If you riffle shuffle, then it's like you have to riffle shuffle half the deck and half the deck and then swap them and then half the deck and half the deck and swap them and then, you know, slot in cards as you go. And
yeah. And
it's just a whole lot of work, and if you do it wrong, then the game is going to play really weird.
I think in general, it's a good idea to try to avoid stuff like that happening, where it kind of ruins the game if you have, like, a physical problem impacting it. I mean, obviously you can't make it perfect, but it just feels awkward.
So maybe, I mean, you could consider it as maybe, like, a matter of scale.
Yeah.
Where rather than, you know, your collection takes 5 cards or more and your deck has 8 cards plus the 3 cards and it takes 9 cards to trade in for a gold rare. It's like, you know, maybe if you can just scale all that down, then you won't need 800 cards in your main shop deck or something like that.
Or it's a matter of considering the setup procedure.
Sure.
Trying to structure the game in a way that lends itself to an easier setup.
Rather than having to put all the cards in one giant deck.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true too.
Sometimes just changing the way the cards are set up in the first place can affect the game in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's sort of the whole point of trade row deck builders.
You know, maybe Nevermore has this thing where they have these, like, cardboard pieces, and you shuffle them and you deal them to determine the order which you reveal certain suits in that game. And each piece represents, you know, a suit of cards that any player could have any number of in their hand. So maybe it's like, you know, that could be a thing.
Or
it's
like Pandemic, you shuffle 4 or 5 smaller decks and then stack them on top.
That's a point. Yeah, you could do that.
So that the cards are evenly paced.
I'm thinking of, like, imagine if you had, like, a token for the core set and then a token for each of the expansions, and you just have proportionally a number of the tokens for the core set, and then dealing to the shop, you deal in the order that you, like, deal the tokens out or something, you know, like,
okay, maybe that, core set. Maybe that's a homebrew experiment worth trying.
Yeah, maybe. And then it eliminates the top cards of decks, of the deck. Maybe you just add a 10th store slot just to simulate that. Either way,
to end on a light note.
Yes.
I want to talk about the theming.
Yeah.
And the art, which again is done by Fabio Fontes.
That sounds right.
He's like the level 99 artist. Art
guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
The art director, maybe even.
So this game is very silly. It has a lot of references, like we mentioned. Like, they're not even, like, subtle references. Like, the Mario set, you know, it's Marvio and Broigi.
Yeah.
But also, the game as a whole has, like, these characters that are very clearly supposed to be, like, Yu-Gi-Oh characters, like a card game anime.
Yeah.
And they all have really silly names, like there is, I can't think of them. I feel really bad for even bringing it up, but there's, like, something Collecta, which is, Card Collecta.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
They all have really punny names. It's completely lighthearted, which I think helps lower the stakes. I mean, like, it's very easy to get wrapped up in, like, the tension, but then you look at the card you bought, and it's a little rabbit named Bubkiss Bunny, and you're like, oh, that's right, it's a silly game.
Right, it's kind of silly. They do pretty well with the references that they make in the game. Yeah. They reference a lot, like, each expansion is its own, is like a whole reference to
a whole,
maybe a video game or a multiple TV series things. Or a game. Yeah.
Like, the Cards Magica set has a bunch of different wizards.
Yeah,
so there's a Harry Potter, like, parody. Tropes. There's a Toho parody.
Right. So, yeah. So, the game, it makes a lot of references. The artwork looks good.
Yeah.
It's the references
appropriately
are good.
Anime.
Yeah.
And I do think, Like, they got a lot of the ideas behind the characters and the theming down. There is an optional game mode we haven't done that adds locations to the tournaments, mm-hmm. which includes things such as dueling on a biplane, as in you're on the wings of a biplane, and riding ostriches while dueling. So they just very, very clearly had their heart on their sleeve, just sort of had fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
Had fun with the references, the characters, the theming.
Yeah. And I mean, props to them for making a game with just a tremendous amount of cards, like so many individual unique cards, and they all have their own individual artwork.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that is our episode on Millennium Blades.
Yep.
Thank you for listening.
As far as games similar, it is hard to say, other than just saying other card acquisition based games like deck builders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's not a whole lot like it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the theme is pretty specific.
Seasons is the closest I can think of, because that one you go in an order of, you know, like you draft cards at the start, then you play them in an order over time.
Yeah, so you might maybe say like games where they have sort of two modes.
Yeah, a dichotomy.
Yeah, yeah, they have one type of game and then another type of game, and they kind of work into yeah. one another. Sure. So yeah, that's Millennium Blades. Thank yeah. you for listening. If you would like, you can follow us on social media, on Twitter and Facebook at BG Bros Cast. It's there that you can interact with us. You can tweet at us, give us some feedback, your comments on whatever. You can just say what's up.
Tell us what you'd like to see.
Sure. Yeah, you can request. We review games. We'll check it out. You can also leave comments on us on any podcasting app, where you can also follow us on any podcasting app. You know, we're pretty much all yeah. over. And you can find us and all of our stuff on our website, which is what I was going to say.
bgbcast.com.
Yep. We post all the episodes there. We tag every episode with what games we talk about, sometimes what mechanics we talk about. So, you can sort of filter through the episodes there to see if you can find one that you're interested in. If there's a specific game that we may have talked about, you can check it out there to see if we did talk about it and what we had to say. Let's see, if you're interested in visiting the websites that we just give you the URLs of to check out, then you should go check out entertainthegeeky.com. That's where our friends Chris and Roger host their own podcast, Entertain the Geeky, where they talk about, you know, anything nerdy, anything nerd culture, whatever. They discuss it on their podcast, and they talk about nerd news on their aptly named podcast, Nerd News, as well.
Well, actually, that's hosted by
sure,
Jason
talks about
either
it.
Way.
Either way, it's on their website.
You should really give him credit.
You should also do some exploring on their website, because it's there where you can find the secret hidden shop where they sell things.
Oh,
Right now, at their shop, you can certainly purchase a copy of our one-page role-playing game, Merle's Truck Stop in Maine. It has a spooky horror theme that's perfect for the merry month of May. It's $5 to get it normally, but at the moment, you can get it for free with promo code GEEKY. That's
G-E-E-K-Y.
Got to do that podcast thing where you spell out the promo codes every time you mention them.
Yeah.
Promo code GEEKY, again, that is G-E-E-K-Y,
yep.
Geeky, for a free copy of Merle's Truck Stop in Maine. Hopefully soon we'll also have t-shirts up for sale
yep.
on that website. We got t-shirts with our logo on them there. And you can get t-shirts for their podcast if you want, I guess. But our t-shirts are probably cooler, in my opinion.
I mean, they do have those little superhero characters.
And it's on that website and through our social media and on this podcast where you can find information regarding our board game company, which we are kickstarting. We hope that the Kickstarter will kick off sometime mid-June. And in addition to just starting the company, we are also collecting funds so that we can publish our very first card game, which is, Matthew, if you would please.
Conniving Cooks, a card game for 2 to 6 players, in which players play as cooks at a fancy restaurant, trying to get the other cooks fired, while also making sure that the guests at the table in your restaurant get their meal.
So be on the lookout for information regarding our Kickstarter, regarding Conniving Cooks. Check out our merch and just be excellent to one another. Because, you know, in these trying times, excellence is key in society.
Yeah.
And that... thank you for listening to our episode. Have a good swell one, everybody. We're going to be a Geek Way.
Oh, yeah. That's this week.
That's this week. Yeah. This podcast release on Saturday, which is day 3 of the Geek Way convention. We will be there all weekend.
We might even play Millennium Blades.
Yeah,
who knows?
Yeah, we might even have Millennium Blades there.
Food Chain Magnate or things that we will cover in the future.
Yeah, we're going to be playing a lot of games at Geek Way. You know, there's that huge library of board games there that you can just, you know, as long as you have the convention pass, you can check them out anytime you want for free and play them and return them. And so we're definitely going to use this as an opportunity to maybe sort of scout out games that we'd like to talk about in the future.
Just try what everybody's talking about.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I haven't played Azul. I haven't played Terraforming Mars.
Yeah, we gotta play these games.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to be doing over the weekend at Geek Way. If you see us there and you're listening to the podcast, feel free to say hi. We'll probably have some merch, you know, our Board Game Bros wise, or maybe Entertain the Geeky wise. Hopefully we do. Maybe we'll just have like a sign or something. I don't know. If you see us, just say hi.
Yeah.
You know, we're happy to meet our listeners and say hi and hang out. Maybe play some board games with us.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So have a happy Geek Way if you're going. If not, happy board gaming.
Oh, you can also see us on Sunday at Miniature Market's location.
Oh, sure.
Miniature
Market, in West County.
St. Louis.
Off of, Manchester Boulevard.
Yeah.
They're having on Sunday
an Entertain the Geeky meet and play board games.
Yes. So it's the same. I mean, Sunday is Geek Way in that we're going to maybe split our time between the two, but we'll definitely be there at some point.
Yeah.
Say what's up. So, yeah. If we see you there.
If you're in the area, yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.